Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
Hi, everybody. We got a great one today, you know, for a change. Today, my guest is Hendrik Hertzberg from The New Yorker. But that's not why this is a great one. I mean, Rick is an unbelievably well-respected writer for The New Yorker, has been for decades. He's won all these awards. He's been winner of the National Magazine Award 3 times. But the reason he's here today and why this is a better than usual interview is that Rick has been a champion of the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. The National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. Now, basically, what that is it's a way to guarantee that the winner of the popular vote in a presidential election will become the president. In other words, everybody's vote counts. And I'll explain the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact in a couple minutes. And then we'll have Rick do a better job of explaining it. That's what we're doing today. But first, I want to talk just a little bit about Gordon Sondland, our nation's ambassador to the European Union, who a couple days ago reversed his testimony about whether President Trump had presented a quid pro quo to the Ukrainian president. Now, originally in October, when he testified to investigators, he said that no, there was not a precondition placed on our giving the $391 million of military aid to Ukraine. But a couple days ago, Sondland returned and said that there were, in fact, conditions placed on that aid. And the condition was that Ukraine would have to do an investigation into the supposed corrupt activities by Joe Biden and his son Hunter, obviously so that President Trump could use that dirt in his reelection campaign against Joe Biden, because he assumed Joe Biden would be the nominee. Of course, he could be the nominee, so it's not a waste of time to do a quid pro quo, even if Biden isn't the nominee. You know, that's how smart Trump is. So evidently, after checking his notes, Sondland realized that his testimony had been wrong. It also might have had something to do with the fact that everybody else who testified said the same damn thing, which was it was a quid pro quo. Mr. Sondland, of course, is not a career diplomat. He is a wealthy hotelier. He owns a chain of hotels called the Counterintuitive Hotels. It's all those hotels where the outlets are behind the couches, and where it's impossible to figure out how to turn off the music that's on when you arrive to make your arrival more pleasant, but you can't figure out how to turn the damn music off. If you travel a lot, especially on you know, business trips, you'll know that Counterintuitive is growing every day. They're the hotels where you have to slide your room key, the plastic room key, in a slot on the wall, a slot that's on the wall, to turn the lights on. And good luck finding the slot in the dark. That's all I can say. Anyway, he's been a big success after starting this Counterintuitive chain. I got to say, I have a lot of concerns about what Trump has done to the Foreign Service. He gave, this guy Sondland gave $1 million to Trump, but he waited till after the election. He was hedging his bets. He gave $1 million to the inaugural slush fund. You know, Trump was thinking, like, how am I going to make money as president? Well, you know, why not start on day one? So this guy is our ambassador to the European Union. You know, talk about counterintuitive. So, of course, the career people have been appalled with Trump since day one, but they haven't said anything until this quid pro quo. There's no question what happened here. It's this, are Republican senators going to vote to impeach him? And Trump himself yesterday said, I could shoot a guy on Fifth Avenue and not be impeached. I don't think the Republican senators will mind that. You know. Well, let's go to the subject at hand today, the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. The National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. And it basically says whoever wins the popular vote for president becomes the president. So, for example, in 2016, Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by about 3 million votes. They may have all been undocumented immigrants who risked being arrested and deported by going into a polling place and breaking the law, or not. So Hillary would have won, and we would not have Gorsuch. We would not have Kavanaugh. We might be addressing climate change. Well, you know. And in 2000, Gore would have won because he won the popular vote. George W. Bush would not have been president. So what happens is if we get enough states with enough electoral votes, with 270 electoral votes to sign on to this interstate compact, then they all agree. They all agree that they will give their electors to the one who got the most votes. So you don't have to amend the Constitution. Colorado, the legislature did this. They passed this legislation, and the governor signed it. So their electors would go to the winner of the popular vote. Now, a number of Republicans have decided this is kind of scary. You know, if Gore had been president in 2000, if Hillary had become president in 2016, and I'm assuming here that Gore would have been reelected, but the Supreme Court would be now 7-2 appointed by Democrats. Okay, so the Republicans, there are some Republicans for this because they know that if every vote counts, more people will get involved. And we want a democracy where people are actually involved, not just people in battleground states, not just people whose October is hell, because if they watch TV, they see nothing but ads. There are like 7 or 8 battleground states, and the rest of the country, really, no one campaigns there. So no one campaigns in California. There's no rallies in Texas during the general election. There's no rallies in anywhere but the battleground states. And this would mean that every vote would count. Now, there's a group called Protect Colorado's Vote, and they want everyone to vote no on this National Popular Vote Compact. This is part of their argument. This end run around the Constitution. Well, no, it's not an end run around the Constitution. If you go to your Constitution, here, go get your Constitution out, everybody. I'll wait. I don't know where you keep it, but okay, I'll give you a little bit more time to get your Constitution. I keep it at the bedside table, and but you know, some people keep it downstairs or maybe listening right now in the car. If you're listening in the car, I don't know if you have your glove compartment Constitution. I do, of course. Okay, so you go to Article 2, Section 1, and it says, each state shall appoint in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct a number of electors. There's nothing in the Constitution about all your electors have to go to the winner of your state's vote. So basically what they have argued is, this takes away the people of Colorado's voice. Well, the people of Colorado voted for Hillary Clinton. I get mad. Okay, the National Popular Vote Bill, this compact, has been enacted by 16 jurisdictions with 196 electoral votes. So it's states like Delaware and Hawaii, like small states, medium-sized states like Connecticut and Maryland and Massachusetts and New Jersey, you know, and big states like California and Illinois and New York. They're about, they're 75 electoral votes short. And, you know, like Virginia just switched. They could pass that this year, this coming year. Now, people will say, Al, why you care so much about this? You know, this won't affect the 2020 election. But, you know, there's a future, everybody. There are years that happen beyond 2020. We want to make sure that Americans are involved in our elections. So Minnesota, all we need to do is pick up the state Senate, and then we got the governor, and we got the House, and then we got the state Senate, and we could pass this thing. That's what this is. So if you don't understand it now, it doesn't mean you're not smart. It means I'm bad at explaining things. Rick Hertzberg will be on, and then you'll get it. Then you'll get it. But this has been entertaining, right? In some small way. And I'll tell you, this is something I have to disclose. I have to disclose this to you. I'm going to get paid to try to raise money for this thing. I'm going to go to different cities. They'll pay for my travel. They'll give me a per diem kind of thing. And I'll finally be able to buy Dianne Feinstein's home. I've had my eye on that place. I like my place in Minnesota, but she's got a great place here in D.C., and this is going to finally give me the nut that I need. Well, anyway, so that's it. Go to the music. So this is about this national
popular
vote. Interstate compact.
Right.
Okay.
So the problem with getting rid of the Electoral College, which American actual citizens have favored for 100 years or more, 150 maybe, is that it's been believed that you have to amend the Constitution, and that is so hard because
because in the Constitution, I'm sure our founding fathers wrote in that each state must appoint electors to vote for the people who win the popular vote in their state. That must be part of it.
No, it isn't.
Like a winner-take-all kind of thing. I bet you, starting at the first presidential election, that must have been what they did, huh?
Right, except wrong, because they didn't all start doing that for about until about 30 years in. And the idea was the Constitution says that the state legislatures shall appoint electors equal mm-hmm. to the number of representatives and senators in that state. And we can get into why they did that.
Mm-hmm. So it says in the actual constitution of the United States. It's called the United States Constitution. Article 2 in Section 1, it gives the states exclusive control over awarding their electoral votes. And this is a quote. Each state shall appoint in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct a number of electors.
Mm-hmm.
So it's up to the state legislature to determine the manner in the Constitution.
Yeah, and it's been done in all kinds of different ways. And as recently as the year 2000, you may recall, the Republican legislature in Florida came pretty close to just voting to give the electors to Bush. Now, they didn't have to, thanks to the Supreme Court.
But they could have done it,
and it would have been perfectly constitutional.
The basic idea here is that you get enough states to sign on to this thing. And right now, there are quite a number of states with quite a number of electoral votes. I think that there are 15 states in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
have passed this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a total of 196 electoral votes. What's happening this year is the Republicans are worried about this. Because the last two elections where the winner didn't actually get the plurality of the votes were Bush in 2000 mm-hmm. and this guy, Trump, our current president, in 2016. He got 3 million fewer votes than Hillary Clinton, although, according to him, they were all fraudulent votes cast by undocumented immigrants.
Yeah, in California mainly.
Yes, and that he appointed a voter fraud commission led by Chris Kobach. They must have found a lot of funny business there, huh?
So much that they seem to have all fainted away.
Well, they disbanded after successfully finding the 3 million. No, they didn't find any, did they?
Not a single one.
Huh. Okay. Well, anyway.
Should I just explain what the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact is and does?
That would be great.
Okay. It's an identical law, identically worded law that each state that wants to go along with this passes, which says, as you noted, that the electors for the candidate winning the national popular vote in our state gets the electors for our state.
Right.
So that way the constitutional directions are followed to the letter. You don't have to change a word of the Constitution. You don't have to go there.
So for those people who thought, like, we're never going to change the stupid Electoral College thing where the way it's been working so that you have the person who gets the most votes may not win. We can never do that because you need, what, 3/5 of the states to amend the Constitution, and the small states get the 2 votes from their 2 senators.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Wyoming gets these 3 votes, and California, which is, I don't know how many times bigger than Wyoming, but certainly 40 or 50 times, mm-hmm. I would think, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
If not more, doesn't get 40 or 50 times as many electors.
No, and it was a dirty deal. It was an embarrassing deal. Madison was certainly embarrassed by it. And it had nothing to do with anything really except it had to do partly with Rhode Island being a small state. And so what Rhode Island was afraid they're going to be pushed around because they were so little.
But what this is if you get enough states where their electoral votes add up to 270
mm-hmm.
to sign on to this compact.
Mm-hmm.
They all agree that they will all give their electors to the winner of the popular vote.
Or they will designate the slate of electors representing the candidate with the most votes in the whole country.
Right. So instead, in 2000, We would have had Al Gore then win the election.
Yeah, and the planet would not be doomed.
Yes, there's that. There's that. And, you know, I think it's fair to say that Bush did not do a great job.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say that Bush, and this is kind of controversial, so far, anyway, if you measure Trump, in many ways, Bush is worse than Trump. It's hard to say that because I see him, I see Trump unraveling democratic norms, mm-hmm. and it's very, very, very frightening. And what we're seeing right now with Foreign Service going around them and having Giuliani conduct our, Jesus Christ.
Well, the only way really that Bush Jr. outdoes Trump is in killing people.
Well, there's that, but there's also the economy. Let's remember, I mean, Trump passed this awful tax cut, weighted very heavily toward those at the top. But you're old enough to remember this, and you can't believe it. But President Clinton handed off a surplus.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that just astonishing to think about?
It's a little known fact.
He handed off, and Alan Greenspan said there was actually a danger of us just paying off our entire debt. And if that happened, you couldn't sell bonds. I mean, that would create chaos. So we had to do a tax cut in order to make sure that the disaster of paying off our entire national debt didn't happen. Literally, that's what Alan Greenspan said.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what George Bush agreed with. And then we had this enormous tax cut. Then we started getting bigger deficits than we had at any time during Clinton. And then he handed off an economy where 800,000 people a month were losing jobs. And he really took his eye off the ball on Al-Qaeda. I think you can argue that Al Gore would have paid attention far more than George Bush did, George W. Bush, because George W. Bush paid no attention. And Condi Rice paid no attention. She was going to give a speech somewhere, I think at Georgetown that day, on her national defense challenges, and her whole big thing was missiles, rockets and missiles. And then they went to war by lying to us in Iraq.
Well, they used the wrong tool for the job. I mean, the job, you had 9/11, you had the Twin Towers destroyed by a few scruffy post-teen fanatics armed with, what, letter openers or some such.
Yep.
The answer to that was not a huge conventional war killing thousands of people. It was the wrong tool
hundreds
for the job.
Of
hundreds of thousands. It was pretty obvious right from the start that was the wrong tool for the job.
It was. He had weapons of mass destruction. He had participated in 9/11 Saddam.
I don't want listeners to get the impression that the National Popular Vote and Interstate Compact is a Democratic plot. It's not.
There are Republicans who are voting for this because they think it makes sense that the president should be the person who gets the most votes.
Yeah, it's not just that. It's also because all but a dozen states are completely left out of the presidential election. Now, it's only a few battleground states that any attention is paid to, that any money is spent in, that any organizing is done. And so the legislators from those flyover states, those nothing states, they can't get their phone calls returned during the general election campaign. Nobody cares. The national candidates don't care about them. They don't go visit their states. They don't pay any attention to their needs. The only states that get anything out of the current arrangement, really, are the few battleground states, the states that are lucky enough or unlucky enough to be subject to a campaign. And even worse, I think, is that organizing, political organizing, and get out the vote drives and talk to your neighbors about who to vote for is completely pointless in 4/5 of the country, in New York, in California, in Texas, in Mississippi, in all these states. What's the point of even having a presidential campaign or paying attention or, for that matter, voting?
Well, if you look at where the events are, like campaign events,
they
during
are,
a presidential election, they are only in battleground states.
That's right. They are only in battleground states. And there are a lot of other interests that are bothered by that. If you run a television station, you're not getting those lucrative ads. If you're a politician,
if you're watching TV, you don't get to see wall-to-wall ads like they do in the battleground states.
Yeah.
You know, maybe the battleground states would go like, holy shit, you mean they can, they'd have to spend their money in California? And instead of us seeing nothing but these things. So the people in the battleground states would stand to benefit a little bit. They'd be able to watch TV in October.
And they also get more, you know, the battleground states get lots more federal money. They get lots more projects.
Yeah, you know,
they
like a declared like a presidential disaster area.
Mm-hmm.
The data there is like they get twice as many events designated as disasters.
That's
and,
right.
And then they get the money for that. And that makes a big difference. There is a way of determining that, but there is a lot of gray area.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have a flood, you know, it being declared a national disaster, a presidential disaster, means an incredible amount in terms of getting homes paid for, getting crucial infrastructure, repaying all the people that had to work during that time to deal with it. And we held our breath a lot of times after a lot of events. And Minnesota at that time was not considered a battleground state until I think people were surprised in 16 that it was.
Yeah, and so Minnesota will get some attention in the coming campaign.
All right. Trump has already been there and said he was going to win it. But he's not. He's not going to win Minnesota because, and I'll tell you why. Last time it was just, we want to change. And I think this time there'll be another, we want to change.
People treat the status quo as if it was laid down by the founders and that this is the way they wanted it to go. It just wasn't. I mean, one of the things that bugs me about all these debates is the way everybody refers to the Federalist Papers as Holy Writ. And they're great. The Federalist Papers are great, but they are political pamphlets written to sell a particular compromise. And a lot of the elements of that compromise, the people who wrote the Federalist Papers hadn't agreed with. You know, Madison thought the best way to elect the president would be by the popular vote of everybody in the country or everybody who was eligible.
And Hamilton liked the electors. He didn't say it should be winner take all.
No. In fact, Hamilton originally wanted to annihilate the states. He wanted to get rid of these artificial bodies called states and have one nation. He wanted to get rid of the states. I mean, maybe they would have kept them for reasons of the post office or postal addresses or something. He wanted us to be a unified state, a unified country like France or England or what have you.
We don't want that.
No, we don't want that, but Hamilton did want that, yet he wrote very eloquently against it.
He was defending the Constitution.
Yeah, they made all their compromises in writing the Constitution, and then they said, you know, this is so much better than what we've got. It doesn't have everything I wanted in it. It's got some things I don't like. But let's go out and sell it because it's the best hope for the country. That's how we started. The framers were not just God sitting up on a cloud handing down wisdom. They were practical men, practical politicians, practical statesmen.
Who owned slaves?
Well, that slavery was a big deal. And in fact, Madison admitted at one point, he put it very delicately. He said that the problem with the popular election of the presidency is that it doesn't take account of the slaves, basically. The slave states, one of the population that your representation in the lower house, in the House of Representatives, would be based on the total human population, you might say, all the people, free and slaves.
And the compromise was the three-fifths thing.
And the compromise were the three-fifths. And, of course, the free states hated that. They thought if the Southerners really thought that the slaves were property, then they shouldn't get any credit for that in the representation of the House. They said, you count your slaves, we'll count our cattle. Now, that sounds brutal, but it's a recognition of reality.
This is all fake history, by the way. Those are fake notes.
Yeah, fake news with long shelf life, yeah.
Well, Rick, you know what? Let's take a break because we have to pay my enormous salary. So we're going to take a break now, and we'll be right back. The best way to learn a language? Immersion. Living where the language is spoken and using it every day. But if that's not in the cards this year, you can still learn a language the second best way, and that's with Babbel. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Babbel's convenient courses have helped me learn real-life conversation in German. For example, let's say you wanted to order soup with your dinner. Die Suppe würde mir auch gefallen. That means the soup. That means I would also like the soup. And that way, I get soup with dinner. Here's a special limited-time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/franken. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/franken, spelled babbel.com/franken. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
What we're talking about now here is what's going on in Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Because Colorado's legislature passed the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact.
Mm-hmm.
And Colorado, both houses of the legislature voted for it, and the governor signed it. And now Republicans are looking at this and going like, geez, they only would need another 74 or 75 electors. And like we're having this conversation the day after the elections in Virginia and Mississippi and Kentucky. And Virginia now has both houses have turned Democratic and have a Democratic governor. There's no reason that they may not do this. And again, you're absolutely right. There are states in which state legislatures, the Republicans, have very heavily voted for this because it just makes sense.
Yeah, believe it or not, I mean, there are a lot of Republicans out there who think that counting the votes and giving the job to whoever gets the most is actually a really good idea. Unfortunately, the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact thing has gotten mired in partisanship because Republicans think that they have been the beneficiaries of the ludicrous way we elect presidents. On the merits, Republicans and Democrats have an equal interest in a rational electoral system, an electoral system that awards the office to the candidate that comes in second rather than first is a bad electoral system. And I've noticed that nobody seems to want to transfer the electoral college system to any other part of our democracy. You don't have anybody suggesting that, well, let's elect the governor by giving, let's give each county 10,000 extra votes just to begin with. And that's that would be a better way. That way the little counties won't be swamped by the big counties. Again, the reason why we have this two-step system, because we were perfectly able to elect in the post-colonial days, in the early days of the Republic, we were perfectly able to elect members of Congress and local officials and mayors and all the rest by the usual method of counting the votes and giving the job to whoever gets the most.
But in some cases, state legislatures were appointing senators, right?
Yes, they were. And interestingly, the popular election of senators came about in much the same way as the national popular vote thing. State legislatures passed bills saying the job will go to whoever gets the most votes. The Constitution has the senators appointed by the state legislatures, but the state legislatures could do it any way they liked. So even before it was in the Constitution, there were states electing their senators by popular vote. And for that matter, there were states let women vote before the constitutional amendment.
I think Wyoming.
That's right. It was Wyoming. God bless them. Uh-huh. A voter in Wyoming is going to have just as much influence as a voter in New York or California under the national popular vote.
And let's face it, that shouldn't be the case. Hey, I want to read you something that this is Protect Colorado's Vote has put out some stuff, and they want to get rid of what the state legislature and passed and the governor signed. And this is a quote. This end run around the Constitution, which just it isn't. It is not an end run around the Constitution.
That's like saying that an end run in football is a way of avoiding the rules of football. An end run is a legitimate play in football.
That's how they start. This end run around the Constitution, which it just absolutely is not, requires Colorado's presidential electors to cast their votes for the candidate for president who received the most votes nationally, even if that candidate did not receive the most votes in Colorado. Now, if you go back to the last election, Colorado, most people in Colorado voted for Hillary Clinton. So Colorado voters voted for Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton won the national vote, but the voters of Colorado did not get what they wanted. Their view was not reflected in this system.
Well, the voters of Colorado were just irrelevant. It didn't matter who they voted for. That was the situation in Colorado.
Well, Hillary got her electors.
Hillary got her electors. I don't think Colorado even in the category of a battleground state?
I think it was for a while, but then toward the end, it was taken for granted, I think, that it was blue. But it's kind of turned blue. Cory Gardner is against the national popular vote, but I don't think he'll be in the Senate after this one. But that doesn't matter. We have to do it this way. In order to get this thing enacted, enough state legislatures have to say, this is what we want to do. We want this compact. We want the national popular vote interstate compact.
Right.
And the governor signs it. If those states get 270 electoral votes, then it takes effect. And those states are bound to give their electors to whoever wins the popular vote.
Or another way of putting it is that the candidate who receives the most votes in every state and the District of Columbia in the whole country gets to be president, no matter what state you live in. Your vote is just as good in a flyover state as it is in a so-called battleground state.
So someone may come and campaign in Missouri.
In Missouri, you might even want to have a little coffee klatch with your neighbors and invite some over and try and persuade them to vote for your candidate. It's not just that the top will be more active, that the campaigns, the national campaigns, will be sending representatives to every state. And it's not just that the TV stations in every state are going to be worth advertising on, no matter where.
The Senate is becoming undemocratic because of that. Mm-hmm. What we're seeing in the Senate is soon 75% of Americans will live in, 13 states or something like that. So in other words, it's something like 30% of the population will have two-thirds of the Senate.
Of the senators, right. And if you look at, I guess, the popular vote, I don't know if anybody ever bothers to add this up, but the total popular votes for Republicans versus Democrats is overwhelmingly now, I think, for the
You're talking about Congress, for Congress.
Congress, yeah, for the mm-hmm. House and the Senate is largely, is a pretty solid majority Democratic.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we had to win, for example, in 2014, there were far more votes for Democrats for House seats than Republicans, but they had the majority of House members, and a lot of that was because of gerrymandering.
Yeah.
What you're saying is, and this is really important, is that more people will vote. People won't not vote in California because, why do this?
Yeah.
Why bother? We know where this is going to go. And that's people from both sides, right? Uh-huh. And same thing in D.C. and the same thing in Wyoming. Why vote?
Look at the turnout in the battleground states versus the spectator states. And it's undeniable. The turnout is just much higher in the battleground states. And if we had a battleground nation, the turnout would be enormous compared to what it is now.
And people would pay more attention, and people would be more engaged, and I think that's good. I think we all agree that's good.
I think so.
And every place would be in play.
And this idea that it's an end run around the Constitution, it's ahistorical.
Well, that literally is not true.
Well, it's literally not true. But
not true.
Right. But people seem to think that the status quo is mandated by the Constitution, the status quo of winner-take-all by state. It isn't, and it wasn't the way it was for the first several decades of the
country. I believe all our founders were dead by the time that was adopted. And you will, there'll be rallies in California.
Mm-hmm.
There'll be rallies in Texas. There'll be rallies in, should I name lots of states now, or do you get the point, everybody? I think you do. But I'll name some other states. There'll be rallies in Oregon. We know where Oregon's going to vote. But, large parts of Oregon are Republican. Why wouldn't a Republican or conservative candidate, have a big rally in Bend, Oregon? Right?
Mm-hmm. If you don't like partisanship, this is a great reform. The reason we have this winner-take-all-by-state thing is that after 20 or 30 or 40 years, we had political parties, which we really didn't have at the beginning. And if your party was in control of a state legislature, you didn't see why you should share this bounty with the other party. Just grab it all for yourself. So hence winner-take-all. And winner-take-all is not in the Constitution. It's not even in reality, because there are two states that don't do winner-take-all. I guess that's Maine.
And Nebraska.
And Nebraska, right. They do it by congressional district plus the mm-hmm. extra two statewide, which isn't a particularly good way of doing it, but it illustrates the fact that there's not holy writ that says it's got to be all or nothing. It's when the parties figured out, when the partisanship emerged and a majority party in a state said, wait a minute, we can take it all. We can just pass a law here where we get all the electors. Well, and they get
also,
none.
We can get it all like in Pennsylvania when they draw up the lines for congressional districts. They gerrymander so that Democratic congressional candidates, House candidates, will win a majority of the votes, but the delegation will be 2-1 Republican.
Yeah, and,
in the House.
If we do get popular vote, I think we can start. Then we can start thinking about ways to do something about that, not just by laws saying don't gerrymander, but by doing things like having 3-member congressional districts instead of single-member districts, spreading it around like that. I mean, there's nothing unconstitutional about any of that. There's nothing in the Constitution that says you have to have single-member districts. You can figure that. Each state can decide to do it any way they want.
What does that mean? Is that these districts are 3 times bigger?
Yeah, the districts would be 3 times bigger. Almost every district, you'd be able to vote for someone who would go to Washington. If you were the minority in one of those 3-member districts, you'd be likely to win one of the 3 seats. If it was overwhelmingly one side or the other in that 3-member district, that one party might get all 3. But most of the time, it would be 2-1. And then you notice that Congress people really do well is constituent representation, like helping people out with their hassles with the VA or something like that.
Sure.
What you don't have is somebody that's representing your political point of view. If you had 3-member districts, you'd have a pretty good shot.
Electing somebody who
represents your political philosophy.
Rick, don't mean to interrupt you, but going to take a quick break and then we'll be right back.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now, imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, 15% off your first order with code WONDERY. So head to BOLLandBranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
We're back with Rick Hertzberg of The New Yorker, and we are talking about the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. I'll bet you there are listeners who are saying, like, I don't like that. Boy, that seems strange. But remember, listener, in life, haven't you had things and gone like, oh, that's that, I don't like that now. And then, you know, a couple years later, you go like, you know, that's good.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. I like that. They did. They had 3-member districts.
Yeah. I mean, Republicans assume that they do badly under the system for obvious reasons. But nobody knows how.
No. Well, this goes back and forth because we thought. The Democrats thought we had the blue wall.
Mm-hmm.
So we thought we had Pennsylvania. We thought we had Michigan. We thought we had Wisconsin. And so we didn't need to win the popular vote. I actually, if you look at this, John Kerry got, I think, a couple million fewer votes, or maybe not that big a margin, but George W. Bush got more popular votes than Kerry, but Kerry came within, I don't know, like less than 50,000 in Ohio to winning the presidency.
Yeah.
So this cuts both ways.
We draw such bad lessons from it. I mean, JFK won the popular vote by around 100,000, and that's only if you count unpledged electors in Alabama. Imagine if Nixon had beaten John F. Kennedy, what were the lessons of 1960 that people would say, well, the Democrats, they went and nominated this playboy, you know, this pretty boy whose idea of a good time, you know, is sailing off of Cape Cod from his palatial estate. And Nixon was a regular American. Of course Nixon won. He was a regular American. And that's the kind of lessons that are being drawn from Hillary's, quote, loss, unquote. Hillary, what did she get, 3 million more votes? Explain that.
Yeah.
Explain
yeah.
that. Explain that. You can't explain that by saying she was a lousy candidate and she didn't have the common touch and et cetera, et cetera. Her defeat was essentially strategic. You can say that the campaign didn't put enough resources into the battleground states. You can say that the campaign paid too much attention to states where the votes don't even count. And what does that tell you? Even if it would come out the other way, if it's just a coincidence, really, that Republicans have benefited lately from this status quo, but it could just as easily turn around the other way. The assumption behind that kind of talk is that there's something more legitimate about counting up the votes and putting the one in the office that got more votes than anybody else. That there's a legitimacy to that than for this, all of this arcane stuff about red states and blue states. I'm in a blue state and I'm blue, but I got neighbors and friends and relatives who are red. This is their state too. And this is their country too.
I think that's incredibly generous of you. For Wow, you're a good man.
Well,
no, but of course. Mm-hmm. So what happens is more people vote.
It makes for a healthier civic atmosphere to have regular elections. And if this system is so great, I challenge its defenders to tell me why they don't believe in imposing it on the rest of our public offices, if it's so wonderful.
Well, I hope we've done this right. I hope people understand what this is, which is basically saying we figured out a way, totally constitutionally, totally in line with what the founders wanted, totally in line with what makes sense, to say whoever wins the popular vote is elected president, like with pretty much everything else. That's what we're saying, right?
Yes, that's what we're saying.
Okay, there, we've said it. All of this stuff is a little bit of civics and history that Americans maybe have lost a little touch with, but I don't think the listeners, I don't think they suffer from that. We did a service today. We did. Thanks, Rick.
Thank you, Al.
Okay, good talking to you, man.
Yep.
Well, I hope you enjoyed listening. That beautiful music is by Leo Kottke, the great Leo Kottke. I want to thank Peter Ogburn for producing this podcast. We'll talk again next week. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that just saved Abercrombie?
Or the tech acquisition that was just like Game of Thrones?
Or the one financial equation that can solve climate change?
Then check out our daily podcast, the best one yet, or as we call it, T-Boy.
This is Nick.
This is Jack.
And we pick the three most interesting business news stories every day for the perfect mix.
20 minutes each morning, you're going to feel brighter.
We call it Pop Biz, don't we, Jack?
Where pop culture meets business news. So whether you want to kick off a conversation with your buddies,
or you're going for that promotion at work,
or you just want to know the trends before your friends,
feel brighter by starting your morning with us every weekday.
Listen to the best one yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your pods.
You can listen to the best one yet ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts.
With shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, and many more, Wondery means business.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you, like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail, or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. I'm Guy Raz, and on my show How I Built This, I talk to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt and failure and talk about how they were able to overcome them on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen to Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.